The F Word at Work from Fertility Matters at Work is a conversation about fertility and how it affects people at work. You'll be hearing from our community about what they experienced whilst trying to build their families, as our aim is to help you better understand this issue by sharing these stories, along with our own insights from the work we are doing. Plus, we'll be talking to the organisations making these cultural changes the norm, as well as bringing you thought leaders from the workplace wellbeing space.
Everyone's got a demand for the manager, but the manager has the same amount of time that they always had, but the demands have increased. I think that's a huge aspect of this, which is the time that's needed to be able to improve this communication, improve the quality of the relationships. It's quite difficult to find. If you've not got a very forward-thinking organisation that's helping you to, in a way, proactively create space, because not many organisations do. It's like, well, yeah, and the response is often, but you're a manager. You're paid as such, you should be figuring this out, which is such an idealistic way of looking at the world and the role of the manager. You know, and I think that's a key point and an action point where organizations can really focus in on something practical. How do we create space for managers to have these very important conversations?
We're delighted that Apricity is sponsoring this series of The F Word at Work. Apricity is the world's first virtual fertility clinic. They use at-home testing and scans, which means just 2 in-person meetings per treatment, compared to around 10 with the traditional model. Apricity's fertility benefit gives end-to-end support and treatment from Apricity doctors and nurses and transparent pricing with no hidden costs. To find out about the unique Apricity fertility benefit and how they can support your employees with inclusive fertility care, to find out more, please get in touch with the Apricity team by going to apricityfertility.com and clicking on the For Employers section. Now on with the show. So welcome to another episode of The F Word at Work, and I'm really looking forward to this conversation. This episode is called Why the Manager Mindset Matters, and I'm really delighted to introduce Wayne Clark. He is the author of How to Become a World-Class Manager. I received a copy of the book the other day, and I've dressed to match the book, as you can see.
Beautifully colour-coded. I love it.
Also, Wayne's the founder of the Global Growth Institute. He's a father. We're going to be talking all about his work and the insights he has on the manager mindset. Wayne, welcome so much to the F Word at Work. It's lovely to have you here.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So can you just start by telling me a bit about you and the Global Growth Institute and the vast conversations with managers that you've had to date?
Well, I guess our work began many years ago, where we started to look at what was it that kept making these organizations sort of dramatically improve their engagement score. So it was it's a huge industry of measuring employee engagement and looking at what it is that drives engagement. We found from our research, and just anecdotal, that all of the CEOs we kept working with kept talking about the need to develop the managers. It was the managers. So either in a positive light or a negative light, our success is here because of the managers. You know, we're a failure because of the managers. And often the managers were the ones who were seen as the people that need to drive everything. And it was something that we wanted to then do a bit of deeper research into, because people kept asking me and saying, you know, we want world-class managers. And I would sit on this side of the table if I was talking to you as the CEO or the HR director, and I'd say, well, that makes a lot of sense. And that's what I used to think. That makes a lot of sense. Who wouldn't want a world-class manager? And then we reached a point about 10 years ago now, I think, where we started to think, well, what is a world-class manager? So we did a piece of research, huge bit of research, actually, all the way from New Zealand through to Brazil and Canada, interviewing CEOs, HR directors, frontline managers, and asking that simple question: what does a world-class manager do, in your opinion? We took all of that insight and then built out what we think were the 12 most important things to focus on. Obviously, it's not a perfect science, right? And, you know, someone said to me a while ago, if management was a science, we'd have an equation for it by now. We've been at this for like tens of thousands of years. But we know that there are some quite simple, repeatable things managers can do, and that's what we based our work on.
And I love that in the way you describe the book, you talk about how what you hope is anyone can kind of pick it up and make an impact within an hour. And I personally found it really interesting, because I'm talking with organizations about the work we do with a view to train managers. And I'm not someone personally who has managed very many people. I've often worked as a freelancer and have been managed and had experience from that part. And so I was really interested to see what I could gain with a view to me, for example, becoming a manager. And it is really concise the way you've laid it out. Before we get into the what's in the book and how the expectation is on managers, because I think there is a huge expectation, isn't there? And then, like you've just said, without there being the training, I just want to talk a bit more about you and maybe your experience in the workplace, because we're ultimately talking about
managers and their role in terms of supporting people who are having struggles when they're building their family. That's the work that we do at Fertility Matters at Work. And that manager piece is so vital. And from your experience, just being in the workplace and from a family building perspective, I mentioned that you were a father. Was it a straightforward experience as far as you were concerned? And did you have good managerial support?
Straightforward, no. It took us like longer than we imagined, so that I can talk a bit about that and the range of emotions. And I think how that's really important, actually. It gave me a brand new view of the world, of looking at what the role of the manager could be in this quite difficult moment for many people. And then I think in terms of a supporting manager, yeah, I'd probably say yes. But at the time, I was sort of transitioning to run my own company. So I was very much moving from corporate, well, 11 years in corporate, and then the rest of it is running my own company. So it was under my own sort of leadership in a way. Yeah. So I think in terms of the relationship with managers, it was only a little bit for me. But in terms of the what we learned in terms of being straightforward, no. And I think the main reason why it took us longer than we anticipated. And in that process, you go through a huge range of emotions.
Because also one of the things that you say in the book is that when you're talking about the definition of a manager, it's anyone who has an impact on someone else's future in an organization. And when we think of a life event like this, trying to have a child, and we sadly know from our findings that people are thinking or actually actively leaving organizations because they don't feel supported. What you've said there about somebody who has an impact on someone else's future in an organization, in terms of family building, it's massively significant. What do you think, from the conversations you've had, managers need to understand then when we're talking about those more emotional life events?
The answer, I guess, more deeply understand the individual, right? Which sounds very straightforward and very easy. Not easy, not straightforward, for a number of reasons. It may be that the relationship between the manager and the person in the team is not deep enough or not good enough to be able to get into those types of conversations. I mean, it's a quite personal space to be in, to talk about this type of stuff with people. And of course, across the genders, that can be even more challenging as well. So I think getting the relationship to the point where this is a conversation that can actually be had, it is the biggest step, I think, in all of this, because the relationships that often exist between managers and people in their teams can be really shallow. Even when people have worked together for 15, 20 years, we found this.
And that communication piece, I know you talk about the importance of good communication and how that is nurtured. It can't just happen overnight. It's all very well going in and saying, right, we're going to be talking about this topic, for example. We expect you as the manager to be able to handle these conversations. We try to approach it in a, we want to give you the tools of like what to say, what not to say. So when you're hearing what managers are struggling with in terms of communication, are they saying that if it's just made simple, we can then take it on? Because otherwise it becomes too much. Is that a fair assessment?
It is a fair assessment. And in order to get to the simplicity, I think the biggest obstacle is probably time. So, you know, the role of the modern manager is more in demand than ever in organizations. And like, you know, a conversation and understanding about fertility is one of many, 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 many things that managers are often expected to be somewhat an expert in. So from ESG to diversity to climate to, you know, there is a huge range of things that the organization looks to the manager to be able to solve. You know, I see it all the time when we sit in leadership team meetings, they talk about the managers. You know, the sales director wants the managers to sell more or to position the organization more. The marketing manager wants the managers to do more with their social media accounts. HR want managers to do more of X, Y, Z. You know, everyone's got a demand for the manager, but the manager has the same amount of time that they always had, but the demands have increased. I think that's a huge aspect of this, which is the time that's needed to be able to improve this communication, improve the quality of the relationships. It's quite difficult to find. If you've not got a very forward-thinking organization that are helping you to, in a way, proactively create space, because not many organizations do. It's like, well, yeah, and the response is often, but you're a manager, you're paid as such, you should be figuring this out, which is such an idealistic way of looking at the world and the role of the manager. You know, and I think that's a key point and an action point where organizations can really focus in on something practical. How do we create space for managers to have these very important conversations?
And then ultimately, there needs to be priorities, don't there, conveyed to the manager about from that senior leadership as to, we need to look at this, then this, then this? Or do you think the manager needs the space to then decide themselves in which order?
Well, I think there's an overarching piece. Actually, it's one of the pieces uploaded at the weekend to LinkedIn was a small piece of, I guess, a speech or a quote that I heard from Steve Jobs. It was beautiful. It was him talking about the role of leadership, which is about creating vision a vision that obviously people were excited about and believe in, and helping everyone to understand it. So, and then his point was, for the role of the manager, is that managers should really be allowed to just get on with it. So in a way, it's like, you know, you could argue that's quite a centralized and decentralized approach of looking at the role of manager, which I think is probably the right type of approach if you've got the right type of leadership team in place that are making those overarching calls in terms of clarity of leadership, clarity of vision. In many organizations, that doesn't exist, not because that they're bad leaders and they don't have a vision, don't have a clue, is that they often do, more often than not they do, but something weird happens in the translation process between you as the CEO, me as the frontline manager. If you're certainly looking at a larger organization, is that your message often goes through a few translation engines, if we looked at it like an AI, right? It goes through a few translation points before it hits me. And by the time it gets to me, if it does get to me indeed, it doesn't really relate to what the origin of the story was. And the conveyance of the context gets difficult as well.
It's like a bad game of Chinese whispers then.
It's a very bad game of that.
Yeah.
And it's constant. And the really crazy thing is that people often believe, and you see it in meetings, let's cascade this. And everyone nods, right? Yeah, we're going to cascade it. And you often want to pause and say, hold on, what does cascade mean? Is there like a fairy that comes in and magically sprinkles everyone with this information and then checks to see if they've understood it? No. And often what happens is, because we said it's going to be cascaded, or even worse, it's going to be communicated, people say, okay, it's going to work. Never works. Hardly ever works.
Now, you mentioned meetings there, and I know in the book you talk about managers talking about their frustration with meetings for meetings, and how you talk about different tools that are much more effective in ways to communicate jobs that need to be done and actioned and what have you, and that meetings should only be a part of the whole process. So when it comes to the best and most effective way to do what we've just described, so we, for example, do awareness raising webinars, and we like to have lived experience within those webinars. So do you think that as a way of learning? Obviously, there's structured learning and kind of e-learning type things. There's text-based learning. Hearing lived experience, for example, and trying to create that empathy. Do you feel that that's an effective method that you've heard managers say works for them?
Yeah, I would actually say it's the best. It's the best form, right? And here's like the unbelievably simple sort of basis of our work and the book and the program, is that we identified high-performing, what we consider to be high-performing managers. Those aren't ones who work their socks off harder than other people and kill themselves doing 70 hours a week. That's not what we mean. These are highly effective managers who manage to deliver for themselves, their teams and the organization, and hopefully who the organization is designed to serve, the customer, the patient, you know, whoever this organization is designed to serve. And we looked at those individuals and said, what is it about them that makes them so successful? We learned about them and we built all of our work based on a sort of best demonstrated practice. And I think creating an opportunity for people to share best practice, to share challenges, to share what worked, what didn't work. There's something that I heard on, I was in Turkey as part of, it was the World Business Angel Forum. And it's an amazing conference organized to sort of match entrepreneurs with funders and investors that come from all around the world. It's fascinating to watch. And one of the things that someone talked to me there about was, they have this thing, I won't say that it's a bad word, but they call it F Up Wednesday, right, in their business. I thought, oh, what a brilliant idea. So every Wednesday they get together purposefully to talk about screw-ups, things that went wrong, what can we learn about it? And it's like, it's a language that many organizations don't have, and it's a conversation many people don't have, which is to look at what can we learn from what didn't go so well. So I think creating those spaces for those types of conversations is key.
I love as well, you talk about how world-class managers are defined by someone else's experience of your management. And again, it's that almost vulnerability to listen to what that experience is, like you say, to learn from maybe what hasn't worked and ultimately improve. But I do wonder, if we're talking about a smaller organization where there isn't as much resource to put the time into the management, whether it's a very different experience from those being managed and the manager themselves. Am I right in saying that it's quite a variety of size of organizations that you've had these conversations with?
Yeah, from the micro to the macro. I mean, from like a true SME micro company of 10 people through to our largest clients, probably more than 250,000 employees, and actually even more, one's even bigger. So there is that range. However, I do recognize, which is why we focus so much on the role of the manager. Often the manager will probably have anywhere between, I'd say on the low end, the smart number is around 4 to 5 people. At the highest, we've seen it up to about 20. It doesn't seem to ever be much more than that. So I'm not really concerning ourselves with the organization per se. It's more looking at the manager's world. And often, if you put like a sort of Natalie Cameron, right, and followed, if you were an employee in an average size organization and followed your world for a week in the life of, and if you looked at most leaders, how many people do they interact with from Monday to Friday? It's not that many. And the people that they'd interact with, if you replicated that exercise over the year and then did an analysis of how many people that they interacted with, it'd probably be a lot of the same people a lot of the time. Most people's world at work is quite small, actually. So, which is why I'm so interested in the role of the manager, because that's my world. If my world feels like it's got better, then my perception of the rest of the organization, even though I'm, you know, we may have operations in Singapore and I'm based in London, I never meet the Singaporeans or the Filipinos, it doesn't really matter. My perception is we're a pretty good company because my world's improved. And selfishly, that's what people are concerned about. If my world feels like it's getting better, then the world's getting better, right?
Exactly. And then you're going to feel that sense of loyalty to where you're working. I mean, we talk about people feeling psychologically safe and bringing their whole self to work and all the things that we talk a lot about in the kind of workplace wellbeing space. But the sad reality that we hear is that people talk about being lucky that they had a supportive manager. And what we're trying to do is ensure that it's not luck of the draw. Do you hear that type of reference as well? People feel, I know you're probably speaking more with the manager than the person's experience of the manager, but
yeah,
we don't want it to be luck. We need this to be understood as an important cultural shift in this level of responsibility that is had, whatever size of the organization. So for people listening, in terms of top tips to get that manager engaged, I mean, one of the things that I know we've had to overcome is when people say, this isn't relevant to me, nobody's come and talked to me about this, so why do I need to learn about it? And we try to highlight people's fear to disclose and why we need that open culture. So if there are managers thinking that a certain topic isn't relevant, or an organization thinking a certain topic isn't relevant, and therefore why do the managers need to be trained? What's your guidance and thoughts on that?
And if I started at the beginning and said, you know, I lecture at a few different universities, and one of the things I talk to undergrads about quite a lot is I try and give them some good coaching on what to avoid, like what red flags to look out for. Because I think, you know, someone would have said that to me, and I've been quite fortunate, you know, the majority of the managers I've ever had have been excellent, you know, world class, as I would even say. So I've been quite lucky in that respect. However, I do know that many people don't have a very similar journey to what I've had. So, you know, with the undergrads, we talk with them about what to look out for in terms of a red flag. And there are two. So we describe what we call the dream manager. And the reason why I think this is important to answer your question is because I think we have a lot of power as individuals. And it might not be, you know, we might be in this destructive, difficult, toxic relationship with a manager, and we can't change the manager, right? So all we can probably change is how we sort of negate that and how we interact with them. If it's that bad and it's possible, then making a move would probably be a smart idea, because life's very short and we shouldn't burn years of our life trying to fix a relationship that actually you've got no idea why that individual's toxic. It might be something deeply disturbing that happened with them 20 years ago that you're never going to be able to change, right? So we can only change so much. But I think if you're going into a new organization, either as you're experienced as a manager or as an employee and you've worked somewhere for a long time, or whether you're a new graduate, there is something to think about with choosing the right manager for you. So we talked with undergraduates about two key things. One is that the manager that you work for, the dream manager, should be well networked. If you get a sense of talking to this individual that they're quite stovepiped and they don't really understand the organization that well, steer clear of that manager. Stay away, right? The reason why is because as a new grad, of course, you should be. You're going to be ambitious. You're going to want to move fast. In order to do that, you need to try and be exposed to as much as you can in that organization. Really difficult if you've got a manager who doesn't know anyone. Like, you want them to be able to pick up the phone and for her to call someone and say, actually, I've got, you know, Mary and my team. I would love to connect them with you. Let them learn a bit about your department. Impossible if they don't know people in the organization. So first one is that, are they well networked? If not, steer clear, right? Red flag. Second thing is, do you get a sense that they actually care about you as an individual? It's a really important question to ask yourself. And you know the answer. You'll know gut feel. You know, we know the answer. We don't need a checklist for this. You'll get a sense. We use our intuition and we get a sense that actually this person probably couldn't care less whether I lived or died. And I've met a few people like that. That probably got other issues going on. But that's a person to probably stay away from, because, you know, so again, if you look at the positive aspects of these two things, if you've got someone who does care about, you know, your growth, your development, your future, if you get a bit deeper, maybe they actually do care about your goals and your life ambitions. Not common, but possible. That's amazing. And if you could combine that with someone who actually understands the organization and says, ah, I get it. You want to develop a strength in improving your stakeholder relationships. I'm going to connect you with Mark, who runs that department. He's got a wealth of experience in that and has done such a great thing here. Go and spend an hour with him. I mean, that's more valuable in some cases than paying for you to go on some, you know, elongated program of learning and development, because that's something that you can apply within the next hour and it really benefits your career. So I think those are two things that sort of overarching point here is that this is all about being consciously aware of the relationship you're getting into with a manager. It's a key relationship. You're going to be with that individual probably more than you are with your friends and family. So this is something really important to think about.
I love what you've just said. And we're ultimately talking about empowering the individual to feel kind of confident enough to say, no, that's not right. Therefore, I want to go over here and move, or I'm going to actively try and change the situation. If we're imagining a person deep in this kind of emotional turmoil of struggling to build a family and their mental health is suffering and they're trying to navigate all that comes with fertility treatment and the day-to-day calls of the ejections and the loss that can come with it as well, and they've got a highly pressured job and they don't feel they've got that within them to say, I need more, or I need this, or I need that. How much is on the manager's shoulders to be perceptive and see what that person might be going through as well?
Well, if you looked at it in like the cold light of day, if you put your business hat on, we just watched this movie Wonka. I don't know if you've seen the new one.
Oh, I love it. Yeah.
Wonderful, isn't it? My youngest, she always has the handshake. Let's do business and sort of shake. You know, if you sort of put your business head on, right, like Slugworth, and say, right, this is all about numbers and all about money. The smartest thing to do is to understand where someone's coming from. The reason why is because whatever's going on for them outside of work, 100% will affect their performance. So even if you didn't care about the person and you were sort of clinically, I don't know, disposed to not be able to care about human beings, you had very low empathy, even in that case, it would make sense to understand what's going on in their personal lives. Because, you know, without understanding that, you're not understanding what's impacting performance. So I think that's such an important focus for the manager.
So as a final kind of thought on the whole manager mindset, and in terms of, I just mentioned it being on the kind of manager's shoulders, we're trying to have the person empowered. I'm interested as well about confidence, both levels, from a manager to be confident enough to maybe try and have more difficult conversations and maybe ask some of those questions, like you said, whether they care or not, but being confident that there is something that needs to be addressed and then having the right language to do it. How much is confidence an issue? Obviously, if somebody's a manager, you'd hope there'd be an element of confidence. But we hear that there's fear of saying the wrong thing often with managers, especially around the more emotive topics. So what's your advice on that?
Yeah, and it's too easy to just assume that managers are by default and they get, you know, some universal given confidence. Not true. Many will be tremendously introverted and all sorts of reasons. So that's not the case. I think the main thing is to, I guess, to enable managers to think through, like, how do they understand the backstory of someone? So during lockdown, I went through this process where I was reading too many LinkedIn posts and I was feeling emotion. Right? So I put out this thing on LinkedIn and said, if anyone wants to do a one-to-one with me as a stranger, I'm up for doing it. And I was at home sitting in the garage, you know, as we all were. And I did 10 one-to-ones with random strangers that I'd never met. Right. And as an exercise, and this is something that I learned, and anyone can follow this, it takes about 90 minutes and it's foolproof. It's a guarantee this is going to work, right? So the first 45 minutes is a practical action. What you do is with the individual in the team, it's even more interesting with a stranger, but with someone that you probably know to some degree, ask them for 45 minutes if they would be prepared to just tell you their life story. Start at the beginning, just talk it through. And they're often like, what? Where do you want me to start? So, well, as much as you're prepared to share and comfortable to share, share with me your life story. I'd love to learn more about you. The reason why I think it's so important, Nancy, is because our life stories for each of us are really important. We're invested in them, right? Because it's our story. It's the most important thing. When would you get an opportunity to sit down with someone for 45 minutes and tell them your life story? I've been with my wife for 25 years. She doesn't want to know. My friends aren't interested. My colleagues, I'm not going to talk to them about that. But it's a really important aspect of our lives, right, to talk about. So 45 minutes, ask someone to share with you their life story. As they're sharing their life story with you, and this is what happened with me in these 10 sort of random one-to-ones, was I noticed as people tell their story, they reach their own realizations all the time about why they do things that they do. why they see things the way that they do, why they react to situations the way that they do. And I think it's a fascinating exercise of helping individuals to understand themselves a bit better, and also for the listener being able to deeply understand this individual. And then once you start to understand the individual, it gives you sort of 10 different layers or more, like an onion, of understanding, wow, I really didn't understand this person. I've done this exercise with people who have worked together, and it's usually worse with men, I'd say, right? Sounds maybe a bit sexist, but I think it's true. I think with men, you know, we're much more superficial. So I've done this, we were working with a property business. So the guys who were running it, I asked them to do this, and they've worked together for 20 years. So imagine you sort of seasoned builder guys, and asked them to conduct this exercise. And they looked at me as if, like, you're joking. But afterwards, they both said to me, you know, I had no idea who this guy was. I've worked with him for 20 years. So partly get them to explain the life story. And then the other thing then is it gives you a whole new appreciation for the individual. So I think this is where managers can start to build relationships with people that it doesn't matter whether you've worked together for a long period of time. This can be a really tremendous exercise to go through. And it helps people to build a sense of empathy, of understanding why they do what they do.
We started talking about time and people feeling time poor. And I wonder if people listening are going, yeah, but when have I got time to do that? Mm-hmm. So how do we get that important exercise and brilliant? And it very much takes me back to how we do our webinars, our in-person events with our panel elements, because that sharing of that life story, people are often like, I had no idea, when it's especially when it's senior leadership talking about something, you know, so personal. If people are listening going, great idea, but when do I do that? Yes. How do we convince them to prioritize that as an exercise?
I don't know whether convincing to prioritize the exercise is going to solve it, because obviously you're going to have, as a manager, this is what we're talking about at the beginning, you've got all of these conflicting pulls on your time, and you've got, on top of all of that stuff we've discussed, you've got the work and the job to do and all the people that you're
doing.
Yeah. The interesting thing about time, this is something that we've looked into a lot. Module 4 of our program is called Optimizing Time. We specifically went after that because that was one of the biggest areas of concern and frustration for not just managers, but organizations all around the world. It's the same consistent issue. And then we figured out there was like a way to kind of solve it, right? Which sounds very simplistic, but it absolutely works and requires a little bit of rigor. The key is, in the midst of the moment, in the present, you've got no time. And there's an often weird belief about time that there was a moment in the past when you had more time, and there's going to be a point in the future when you're going to have more time. And the truth is, you never have any more time because you're always really, really busy and things never get slower. The key is, though, if I said to you, could you go on holiday for a week in March? You're probably going to say impossible because your diary is going to be already booked up. Could you go on holiday in September? Probably. Why? Because your diary probably looks a little less busy in September, like most people. So maybe what you could do is you could start to schedule some time in the future. That might not be an immediate solve to the problem, but it does provision that time. And things will magically work around that time, as if you needed to go to the doctor's or dentist or go to the gym or whatever. You know, it's something that would work your time around and would make it possible to do it. I think this is a really important thing. Often as busy managers, we feel like we can't solve these issues because in the midst of the moment, I have no space. That's okay too. But you will have in a month or two. Try and book that time in, and then it makes it possible to have the conversations that are necessary.
Such wise advice. It's do something rather than nothing, because otherwise you're going to be in exactly the same place.
Yeah, yeah. Which again, for the member of the team that might be going through distress and might be going through a difficult, challenging time. I mean, the number of people that I've spoken with over the years, we've had, you know, really difficult moments with miscarriages, really severe stuff that people have been through. Scheduling a conversation in a few months' time is not going to help them to alleviate some of their concerns or to share some of the burden of the difficulty that they've been going through. So that's where I think as a manager, you do need to try and build in more flexibility into the schedule and have regular one-to-ones. It's one of those things we talk about with managers where we say, if you looked at best practice of all the companies we've come across, the best managers in the world, based on everything that I've seen, will have regular one-to-ones with people. The response to, if I talk at a conference to, I don't know, a few hundred people and say this, everyone will agree. But it's very few people who actually do it because it requires a flexibility and agility of being a manager and prioritizing your tasks and keeping that space free, which is the key. What one of the guys that we saw a number of years ago, a guy called Jim Collins, who was the author of Good to Great, sort of very famous author and something, you know, someone that really blew me away when I watched him speak, was he talked about great managers and leaders in his experience should be spending between 10 to 20% of their week doing nothing other than being sort of conscious of what's going on in their team and the organization. And most leaders would say to you, impossible, how can I spend a day a week? Well, you can't in the present, but using what we've sort of just discussed, it is possible to do that. And that means you've got the flexibility to be able to spot David's going through a difficult moment, and combined with what we've discussed, that I actually cared enough to understand his story, understand what's going on for him and for them at home in building a family, and therefore I can react quick enough. That is the dream manager. And this is exactly what you should be looking out for in a great manager.
I don't know whether in the book, there's an example I read, I don't know whether it's what you just referred to, but you talked about a manager who spends like a day of his week going around asking everybody like how they are and where they're at. And colleagues were like, what? And you call yourself a manager, you call yourself best, you know, in practice, because that's what you're doing. But it's exactly the reason that you've just said. And hopefully that creates that open culture and that conversation and that loyalty and that feeling from Dave, who's going through the stuff at home, to say to the manager that, yes, actually, no, it's not this, or I'm not great. And I think it's brilliant how you've just spelled it out. It doesn't have to be rocket science. It's so obvious. We just want to highlight how obvious it is. You know, talking to people, asking how they are on a regular basis is going to hopefully make everybody's experience at work much better.
And here's maybe a bit of a contentious point, right? And this doesn't go down very well when you're talking to a group of a few hundred people. As I say, given all the advice, all the things that we've learned, everything that's in the book, all the best practices, and there's like hundreds of practice action points, arguably 90% will do nothing with this. Right? This is like one of the sad truths. Not sad in a way, sad for us, because obviously we're purists and we want people to be able to get the very best from themselves and their teams. But I mean, sad from the point of view that it's so difficult to be able to focus on this stuff because of the wave of stuff being demanded of us, not just at work, but also any free time that many people have probably got is then attacked by whatever social media channel you're spending time with. This is absolutely sucking up the time of people. One of the companies we work with, I spoke with a young lady who's probably, I'd say she was like mid to late 20s. She was spending 3 hours a day on TikTok. And this isn't uncommon, right? Whether it's Instagram, whatever, Snap, whatever, but it's 3 hours a day. And that was mixed between daytime and evening time. Any of the literature you look at, which says, how long does it take to refocus on a task, having lost your attention to something else, we'll say it's never instant, whatever study you look at. So imagine going through the day and constantly breaking your attention span and how anxiety fueling that is. So this is what a modern manager is faced with, this unbelievable raft of complexities to deal with at work and understand how people are reacting, interacting with this content. And it's not just in your control at work, you've got all these other influences, right? So it's a fascinating new world to be in as a manager. Who would do it? Who would be a manager? Insane thing to do.
But if you're going to do it, get hold of a book that can help you be a world-class manager. Wayne, it's been an absolute pleasure. I feel like I could ask you so many more questions, but thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, for continuing to get into the manager mindset, because I think it's a constantly, like you say, it's a constantly evolving group of people that need to be better understood, ultimately, for the business to run as we want it to. Thank you, Wayne.
Pleasure. Thank you so much.
Do follow us on our socials at Fertility Matters at Work on Insta and LinkedIn, and at Fertility Matters Work on Twitter. Plus, we've got lots of free resources to download at fertilitymattersatwork.com.